A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Most people, if they know anything about Israeli aviation, know El Al. The security checks, the ex-shin bet guys in plain clothes, the reinforced cockpit doors, the whole mystique. But Israel has two other airlines, and one of them has been quietly transforming itself under wartime pressure. Daniel wants to know about Arkia. What was it historically? What's it doing now on long-haul routes it was never built for? Why are the passenger reviews so consistently grim? And does it have what it takes to actually deliver quality medium and long-haul service? Or are travelers going to keep grimacing every time they see that blue and red logo on their boarding bars? Arkia, which spent 70 plus years doing short domestic hops to Eilat, suddenly found itself filling the gap on routes it was never built to fly. New York, Bangkok, long-haul destinations. But here's the thing. Passenger reviews are consistently grim. Daniel wants to know who Arkia actually is, and whether this airline has what it takes to deliver quality medium and long-haul service, or if travelers are just going to keep grimacing every time they see that booking option.
This is a fascinating case study in organizational stress. You've got an airline that was essentially a domestic bus service with wings being forced to become a transcontinental carrier in under 18 months. Arkia was founded in 1949. Its original name was Arkia Inland Airlines, and the mission was dead simple: connect Tel Aviv to Eilat and a handful of other domestic points.
So where do we even start? Who's Arkia? And how did a domestic charter airline end up flying to New York?
Arkia was founded in 1949, right at the founding of the state, basically. Its original mission was connecting Tel Aviv to Eilat, and for decades that's mostly what it did. Domestic routes, some regional charters to Europe, but the identity was always the airline you take to get to the Red Sea. The fleet reflected that. ATR-72 turboprops, Embraer 19s, previously some Boeing 757s for niche European charters. They did operate some larger aircraft over the years. Boeing 757-300s, mostly on charter work to Europe.
The 757 could stretch its legs a bit, but you're right. That's a narrow body doing maybe 4 or 5 hours to Europe, not a wide body crossing the Atlantic.
The airline's entire operational DNA was built around getting you there fast and getting the plane turned around for the next flight. The question isn't really, is Arkia a good airline? The question is, what happens when a regional domestic carrier is forced by geopolitical circumstance to become a medium and long-haul lifeline, and whether an airline built for 45-minute hops can deliver on routes that are 4 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours long?
So it's the gap between what the organization was designed to do and what it's now being asked to do. And that gap shows up in every passenger review.
Air Canada pulled out in October 2023. United suspended in July 2024. Delta followed in August 2024. Wizz Air and Ryanair paused multiple times. They'd restart. Something would escalate. They'd pull out again. Ethiopian Airlines suspended. Dozens of others reduced frequencies or cut routes entirely, and by mid-2026, many of them still haven't returned, or they're operating at a fraction of their previous frequency.
And that leaves a pretty stark choice for anyone who needs to fly in or out. El Al, which is expensive and was already running near capacity on many routes, or
Tel Aviv to New York, Tel Aviv to London, Tel Aviv to Bangkok. These are routes where foreign carriers were carrying a huge share of the traffic, and suddenly, they were gone. El Al couldn't absorb all of it. Nobody could. So Arkia, and Israel, to a lesser extent, stepped into the vacuum. The JFK route is the most dramatic departure. That's a 10-hour flight from an airline whose historical average flight time was under 90 minutes.
Wait. Under 90 minutes. So, for most of its existence, the typical Arkia flight was shorter than a movie.
A wet lease means you're not just renting the plane, you're renting the plane, the crew, the maintenance, and the insurance from a third-party operator. Arkia's name is on the ticket, but the metal and the people operating it belong to someone else. You need different galley provisioning. A 50-minute flight might serve a snack and a drink. A 10-hour flight needs 2 full meal services. You need crew rest facilities. On a long-haul flight, the pilots and cabin crew legally have to have rest periods, which means you need bunks or rest seats. You need in-flight entertainment systems that work for 10 hours, not just an overhead screen showing the flight map. You need different maintenance infrastructure, different crew training, different passenger expectations to manage.
So they essentially had to build a long-haul airline from scratch, in under 18 months, with aircraft they'd never flown.
That adds probably 90 minutes to the total journey time versus a non-stop, and you're doing it in a single-class cabin with 148 seats at 29 to 30 inches of pitch. They're 4-engine aircraft in an era when everyone else has moved to twin-engine wide-bodies for fuel efficiency. And that's not a coincidence. It's the same product. The 737-700's Archaea is using weren't configured for long haul. They're standard short to medium-haul layouts.
A domestic charter airline suddenly trying to sell first-class suites.
Right. And think about what that means operationally. First class isn't just a bigger seat. It's a completely different service proposition. Dedicated check-in, lounge access, multi-course meals, premium beverages, amenity kits, priority baggage. Archaea's ground staff at Ben-Gurion had spent their careers handling Embraer 190 turnarounds to Eilat. Now they're supposed to manage premium passengers on a 10-hour transatlantic flight.
I'm trying to imagine the first week of that JFK route. The check-in counter, the gate agent looking at a first-class boarding pass, and just not knowing what to do with it.
How often do you do water runs? Short-haul crews aren't trained for the pacing of long-haul service. The overnight quiet periods, the multiple meal cycles, the passenger comfort checks over many hours. They have maintenance infrastructure at Ben-Gurion built around wide-body aircraft. They have a loyalty program, premium cabins with lie-flat seats, kosher meal services designed for long-haul flight rhythms. Archaea had none of that. They had to hire pilots with type ratings they'd never needed before. An A340 type rating is completely different from an Embraer 90 type rating. They had to retrofit cabins. They had to figure out catering for 8 and 10-hour flights.
And this wasn't a strategic choice. This is the thing I think people miss when they look at this from outside. Archaea didn't wake up one morning and decide to become a long-haul carrier. The market collapsed around them, and they were one of the only Israeli carriers besides El Al with the regulatory authority and the willingness to fill the gap.
And here's the thing. Archaea's fares on these routes are often comparable to El Al's, because the capacity vacuum means they can charge a premium. The regulatory piece is important too. To fly to the United States, you need FAA approval, you need TSA compliance, you need all kinds of bilateral agreements and security arrangements. That's the structural grimace. But there's another layer here, which is the operational reliability. Archaea's on-time performance on long-haul routes is about 67% versus 82% on their short-haul domestic flying.
So they had the regulatory skeleton. They just didn't have the operational muscle.
And the operational muscle is what determines whether the passenger experience is tolerable or miserable. So let's get into what it's actually like to fly Archaea long-haul. The reviews tell a pretty consistent story.
I've been reading through these. It's not pretty.
When something goes wrong, a maintenance issue, a crew timing out, a weather diversion, your ability to recover is limited because you don't have spare aircraft sitting around. Archaea's own fleet is all short-haul planes that can't sub in on a New York route. Meals that feel like they were designed for a 3-hour European hop stretch to cover a transatlantic crossing.
A cold sandwich on a 10-hour flight? That's not a catering failure. That's a category error.
Archaea's 737-700s needed temporary ETOPS exemptions from Israel's Civil Aviation Authority to operate these extended overwater sectors. Those exemptions come with operational restrictions, stricter alternate airport requirements, more conservative fuel planning, specific routing constraints. On a 10-hour flight, that's a long time to stare at the seat back.
Or you divert more readily than an airline with full ETOPS certification and a fleet of aircraft designed for the mission.
And diversions on a wet-leased aircraft with a third-party crew are a logistical nightmare. The crew might not be rated for the diversion airport. The ground handling arrangements might not exist. The passengers are stranded, and Archaea's ability to recover them quickly is limited because they don't have a hub operation at JFK or Bangkok. They have a single flight a few times a week. The infrastructure just isn't there.
So the reviews aren't saying the airline is dangerous or the staff are rude. They're saying the hard product is aged and the operational reliability is shaky.
That's nearly a full point drop when they go long. The fares are often significantly cheaper than El Al, and the load factors are high. People are choosing Arkia despite the complaints, because the alternative is either much more expensive or simply not available.
That's the structural trap. Arkia needs to fill seats to justify the wide-body leases. The passenger experience is poor, which drives negative reviews. The negative reviews make it harder to attract premium passengers who'd pay higher fares. So they're forced to compete on price, which limits the revenue available to upgrade the cabins and fix the catering and improve the operation. It's a spiral.
And the spiral has a clock on it. As long as foreign carriers stay away from Tel Aviv, Arkia has a captive market. That's a catering planning failure that's directly tied to the short-haul to long-haul mismatch. On a 2-hour flight, you stock a certain number of sandwiches and you're done. On a 12-hour flight, passengers are going to want multiple meals, snacks, water throughout. If your provisioning model is still built around the short-haul assumption, you undership badly.
The seat complaint comes up over and over. And it's not just the seat was uncomfortable, it's specific. Hard cushioning, thin padding, limited recline, narrow width. People describe back pain, numb legs, inability to sleep.
Quality medium and long-haul service requires 4 things. Consistent hard product, seats, IFE, power outlets that actually work. There's a review from the JFK route where a passenger said, and I'm paraphrasing, "I've flown Spirit and Frontier domestically in the US, and this was worse because at least on Spirit you know what you're getting, and it's over in 3 hours. Crew trained for long-haul fatigue management and service rhythms. On a short flight, you're constantly moving. On a long flight, you need to pace yourself, manage rest periods, handle the mid-flight lull when everyone's asleep. And operational reliability, maintenance spares, diversion planning, crew scheduling that can absorb disruptions without cascading into 12-hour delays."
And right now, Arkia scores poorly on 3 of those 4.
If you book Ryanair, you know you're getting nothing. If you book a full-service airline at a full-service price, you expect a full-service product. Arkia's pricing doesn't match its product, and that's where a lot of the anger in the reviews comes from.
The delays are the other recurring theme. 67% on-time performance means 1 in 3 long-haul flights is delayed. And when you're delayed on a twice-weekly route, the next flight isn't in 4 hours. It's in 3 or 4 days.
Communication during disruptions is another complaint that shows up repeatedly. Passengers report being left at the gate with no information, no rebooking assistance, no hotel vouchers. Again, this is partly the wet lease problem. Arkia doesn't have ground staff at JFK or Bangkok the way El Al does. They're relying on contract handlers who may not have the authority or the information to help stranded passengers. If something breaks and the part isn't in stock at Ben Gurion, you're waiting for it to be flown in from Europe or Asia. That's not a same-day fix, that's a ground. The aircraft for 2 days fix.
And every time an aircraft gets grounded, the schedule falls apart. The next flight gets delayed. The crew times out. Passengers get stranded. The poor communication reviews make perfect sense if you picture a ground staff that's never dealt with a 10-hour delay before and doesn't have the procedures or the authority to handle it.
There's a specific review I came across that captures the whole thing in one experience. Passenger writes, "The plane was clean, but the seats were worn, the entertainment screen didn't work, and the meal was a cold sandwich on a 10-hour flight. But that doesn't make the product sustainable at current quality levels. The foreign carriers are going to come back eventually. United has signaled a potential return. Delta will follow."
That's the verdict, really. Arkia has the willingness, but not yet the infrastructure. It's a regional carrier wearing a long-haul costume.
Whether it can grow into the costume depends on 2 things. How long the geopolitical window stays open. If foreign carriers start returning to Tel Aviv in force, Arkia's wide bodies become stranded assets overnight. They've announced plans to acquire Airbus A321 XLRs with deliveries expected in 2027 to 2028.
The other path is that they don't invest. They treat this as a temporary wartime measure, milk the captive market for as long as it lasts, and then retreat back to short haul when the foreign carriers return. That'd be the rational short-term play, even if it means the reviews stay dismal.
That's the tension that makes this case study so interesting. Archaea is a 75-year-old airline that spent most of its existence doing one thing really well, short domestic hops with small aircraft. Now it's being asked to do something completely different, under enormous time pressure, with equipment it doesn't know and passengers it never planned to serve. The fact that it's managing to operate these routes at all is impressive. But managing to operate isn't the same as delivering a quality product.
The load factors suggest passengers are willing to tolerate the rough edges for now. But tolerance has a shelf life. If the war ends, if the foreign carriers come back, if suddenly there's a Delta flight to JFK with lie-flat seats and working IFE and a proper meal service, Archaea is going to have a very hard time competing on price alone.
Pivoting to long haul isn't just a fleet decision, it's an organizational transformation.
There's a comparison worth making here. Norwegian tried the long-haul experiment with 787s a few years ago. Purpose-built aircraft, a proper long-haul product, significant investment.
I pushed back Embraers for Archaea in 2019, ground handling at Ben Gurion. The 19Es to Eilat mostly. I remember looking at the fleet and thinking, this airline will never fly anything bigger than a regional jet.
What was the ground operation like back then?
Small. Tight. They knew exactly what they were doing because they'd been doing the same thing for 50 years. Turn around in 30 minutes, push back, next one. When they brought in the A340, they didn't have a single mechanic with a wide body rating. Had to fly in contractors from Europe.
Let's talk about the regulatory dimension for a moment. Israel's Civil Aviation Authority granted those temporary ETOPS exemptions, which is unusual.
I know because I dated one of them. She was an A340 specialist from Lufthansa Technik, came over on a 6-month contract. She said the first 6 months were a nightmare, parts weren't stocked. Manuals weren't translated. Half the documentation was still in French from the Air France days. The aircraft got grounded twice for issues that would have been a same-day fix at El Al. They just didn't have the spares, or the people who knew where to look.
That explains the delay pattern. If the aircraft aren't mechanically reliable, the schedule falls apart, and that cascades into everything else. The poor communication, the stranded passengers, the negative reviews.
She said the biggest problem was the APU. The auxiliary power unit on those A340s is a specific Honeywell model, and the mean time between failures on a 20-year-old APU isn't great. When it goes, you can't start the engines without a ground power cart. And if you're at JFK and you don't have a contract with the ground handler for that specific equipment, you wait.
A 20-year-old APU fails at JFK, and Archaea doesn't have the ground handling contract to get a power cart quickly.
4 hours once, she showed me the delay report. 4 hours sitting at the gate at JFK because the APU quit and nobody knew who to call.
That's exactly the kind of second-order problem that doesn't show up in the fleet announcement press release. I think the grimace is rational, and it's likely to persist until at least 2027 or 2028 when the XLRs arrive, if they arrive. Between now and then, the structural problems can't be fixed with better service alone.
She said El Al's maintenance operation is basically a small factory. They've got wide-body rated mechanics who've been working on 747s and 77s and 787s for 30 years. Parts warehouses, engine shops, the whole thing. Archaea was trying to build that from zero with contractors who are going home in 6 months.
The seat is the seat. You can't train a seat to be more comfortable.
She left after her contract. Took a job in Singapore. I don't think Archaea ever built the in-house capability. They just kept rotating contractors.
That's a structural problem that doesn't solve itself. If you're relying on contract maintenance for your wide-body fleet, you're paying a premium for labor, you've got no institutional knowledge accumulation, and you're vulnerable to contractor availability, and charging Greyhound prices for it.
She said the A340 is a good aircraft if you know what you're doing, but it's not forgiving. It's a four-engine widebody from the late 90s. It needs more maintenance than a 787, more fuel, more attention. Archaea bought capability they didn't have the infrastructure to support.
The APU detail in particular. That's the kind of thing that doesn't occur to you until you've been doing long haul for years. A domestic regional carrier never has to think about what happens when the APU fails at a foreign station, because their flights are 50 minutes and they never leave their home maintenance base.
She had this saying, the aircraft knows what it is. The airline hasn't figured it out yet.
That's the episode in one sentence.
I still have the delay report somewhere. 4 hours, gate C-14 at JFK, APU failure, no ground power contract, 400 passengers watching the seatback screens not work.
Where does that leave Akia? It's an airline in a very specific kind of trap. The maintenance gap Hilbert's describing is a problem that takes years and serious capital to fix. It won't. The moment Delta and United are back on Tel Aviv to New York, Akia's JFK route is going to bleed passengers.
The open question is whether they're treating this as a temporary surge or a permanent transformation. Which means the clock is ticking. Akia has maybe a year, maybe two, before the competitive landscape normalizes. If the XLR order slips or the product investment doesn't materialize, the long-haul experiment could end badly. If they're just surviving, just keeping the aircraft in the air until the foreign carriers come back, then all of this gets wound down and they go back to islet shuttles.
If foreign carriers do return to Tel Aviv in force, those wide bodies become stranded assets. You can't just park an A340 and hope the lease payments stop. Those are long-term financial commitments. If the market shifts before Akia has built the product to compete, they're left holding aircraft they can't fill and can't afford.
Of course it was. If Akia can get the product right, they could emerge from this as a legitimate second long-haul carrier, not just LL's rougher, cheaper shadow.
The thing I keep coming back to is that none of this was planned. Akia didn't choose this moment. The moment chose them. And they're trying to build the airplane while flying it, literally. That's a hard thing to do well.
It's almost impossible to do well. Most airlines spend years planning a long-haul route launch. They do market analysis, they configure the aircraft, they train the crews, they set up the station operations, they run proving flights. Akia did it in months, with leased aircraft they'd never operated, during a war, with contractors filling the gaps. The fact that the planes are flying at all is remarkable. But remarkable isn't the same as good.
If you take one thing from this, it's the gap between what an organization was built to do and what it's being asked to do. Akia's entire operational DNA. Its fleet, its crews, its maintenance, its catering, its ground handling was optimized for 50-minute domestic flights. You can lease a bigger airplane, but you can't lease 75 years of long-haul experience. That gap shows up in every cold sandwich and broken IFE screen and 4-hour APU delay.
The thing that changed how I see, it's the maintenance dimension. I've been thinking about this as a passenger experience problem. Bad seats, bad food, bad entertainment. But Hilbert's point about the APU and the parts inventory and the contractor rotation makes it clear that the passenger experience is downstream of a deeper operational problem. You can't fix the sandwiches until you fix the maintenance. You can't fix the delays until you fix the parts supply chain. The hard product isn't just aged, it's unsupported.
Next time you book a flight to Tel Aviv and see Akia as an option, you'll know exactly what you're signing up for. An airline that's trying to do something it was never designed to do, with equipment it doesn't fully know how to maintain, in a market that could shift under it at any moment. Whether that's a temporary fix or a permanent problem depends on how long the window stays open, and whether Akia uses it to actually build the airline it's pretending to be.
That culture, the basket of snacks, the pilots unloading bags, the quick turns, that's the airline that's now flying to New York.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions about airlines, infrastructure, or anything else that's been nagging at you, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go from sloth slow takes to facts on cue. We chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.